Here there was an expectation of it. But the first time it had been tried right here, the soldiers ordered to clear things up had balked. And that must have frightened the leadership in their plush and comfortable offices. Because when the organs of the state refused to do the bidding of the state, that was when something called revolution started. And in a place where there had already been a revolution, enshrined on this very spot. And so the initial troop formations had been pulled back and replaced with others, drawn from farther away. Young soldiers. All soldiers were young, Nomori reminded himself. They had not yet been contaminated by the words and thoughts of their contemporaries demonstrating in the square. Not yet sympathetic with them. Not yet willing to ask themselves why the government, which gave them their weapons and uniforms, wished for them to hurt these people instead of listening to what they had to say. And so they'd acted like the mindless automatons they'd been trained to be. There, just a few yards away, were some soldiers of the People's Liberation Army on parade, wearing the strange wax doll look they tended to have, looking not quite human in their green wool uniforms. Almost as though they used makeup, Chet thought, wanting to look more closely at their faces to see if maybe they really did. He turned away with a shake of his head. He hadn't flown JAL to China for that. Wangling this assignment for Nippon Electric Company had been difficult enough. It was a major drag working two jobs, as an upper-middle account executive for NEC and a field intelligence officer for CIA. To succeed in the second, he had also to succeed in the first, and to succeed in the first, he had to simulate a true Japanese salaryman, one who subordinated everything short of his breathing to the good of the company. Well, at least he got to keep both of his salaries, and the Japanese one wasn't all that bad, was it? Not at the current exchange rate, anyway. Nomori supposed that this whole deal was a great sign of confidence in his abilities. He'd established a modestly productive network of agents in Japan who would now report to other CIA case officers. And also of desperation. The agency had been singularly unsuccessful in getting a spy network operating over here in the PRC. Langley hadn't recruited many Chinese Americans into the fold, and one of those it had gotten was now in federal prison after having developed a serious case of divided loyalties. It was a fact that certain federal agencies were allowed to be racist, and today Chinese ethnicity was strongly suspect at CIA headquarters. Well, there wasn't anything he could do about that. Nor could he pretend to be Chinese himself, Nomori knew. To some half-blind racist European types, everyone with crooked eyes looked the same. But here in Beijing, Nomori, whose ancestry was 100% Japanese, albeit entirely of the Southern California variety, figured he stood out about as much as Michael Jordan would. It wasn't something to make an intelligence officer without diplomatic cover feel comfortable, especially since the Chinese Ministry of State Security was as active and well-supported as it was. MSS was every bit as powerful in this city as the Soviet KGB had ever been in Moscow, and was probably just as ruthless. China, Nomori reminded himself, had been in the business of torturing criminals and other unloved ones for thousands of years, and his ethnicity would not be overly helpful. The Chinese did business with the Japanese because it was convenient. Necessary was a more accurate term. But there was precisely zero love lost between the countries. Japan had killed far more Chinese in World War II than Hitler had killed Jews. A fact little appreciated anywhere in the world, except, of course, in China, and that set of facts only added to a racial, ethnic antipathy that went back at least as far as Kublai Khan. He'd gotten too used to fitting in. Nomori had joined CIA to serve his country, and to have a little fun, he'd thought at the time. Then he'd learned what a deadly serious business field intelligence was, followed by the challenge of slipping into places he wasn't supposed to be, of obtaining information he wasn't supposed to get, and then giving it to people who weren't supposed to know it. It wasn't just serving his country that kept Nomori in the business. There was also the thrill, the rush of knowing what others didn't know, of beating people at their own game, on their own turf. But in Japan, he looked like everyone else. Not here in Beijing. He was also a few inches taller than the average Chinese. That came from his childhood diet and American furniture, and better dressed in Western-style clothes. The clothes he could fix. His face he could not. For starters, he'd have to change his haircut, Chet thought. At least that way he could disappear from behind, and perhaps shake an MSS tail that way. He had a car to drive around, paid for by NEC, but he'd get a bicycle too, a Chinese make rather than an expensive European one. If asked about it, he'd say it was good exercise. And besides, wasn't it a perfectly fine socialist bicycle? But such questions would be asked, and notice of his presence would be taken. And in Japan, Nomori realized, he'd gotten slack and comfortable running his agents. He'd known that he could disappear in a place as intimate as a steaming bathhouse, and there talk about women and sports and many other things, but rarely business. In Japan, every business operation was secret at some level or other. And even with the intimate friends with whom he discussed their wives' shortcomings, a Japanese salaryman would not discuss goings-on in the office until after they were overt and public. And that was good for operational security, wasn't it? Looking around like any other tourist, he wondered how he would handle such things here. But most of all, he noticed that eyes lingered on him as he walked from one side of this immense square to the other. How had this place sounded when the tanks were here? He stood still for a moment, remembering. It was right there, wasn't it? The guy with the briefcase and shopping bag who'd held up a company of tanks, just by standing there. Because even the private in the driver's seat of a Type 80 PRC tank didn't have the stones to run over the guy, despite whatever his captain might have been screaming at him over the interphones from his place on top of the turret. Yeah, it was right about here that had happened. Later on, of course, in about a week, the guy with the briefcase had been arrested by MSS, so said CIA's sources, and he'd been taken away and interrogated to see what had persuaded him to take so public and so foolish a political stand against both the government and the armed forces of his country. That had probably lasted a while, the CIA officer thought, standing here and looking around from the spot where one brave man had taken his stand. Because the MSS interrogators just wouldn't have believed that it had been one man acting on his own. The concept of acting on one's own was not something encouraged in a communist regime, and was therefore entirely alien to those who enforced the will of the state on those who broke the state's rules. Whoever he'd been, the guy with the briefcase was dead now. The sources were pretty clear on that. An MSS official had commented on the matter with satisfaction later on, before someone whose ears were distantly connected to America. He'd taken the bullet in the back of the head, and his family, a wife and an infant son, the source believed, had been billed for the pistol round needed to execute the husband, father, counter-revolutionary, enemy of the state, in question. Such was justice in the People's Republic of China. And what was it they called foreigners here? Barbarians. Yeah, Nomori thought. Sure, Wilbur. The myth of central position was as alive here as it had been on the coup d'etat of Adolf Hitler's Berlin. Racism was the same all over the world. Dumb. That was one lesson his country had taught the world, Chester Nomori thought, though America still had to absorb the lesson herself. She was a whore, and a very expensive one, Mike Riley thought from his seat behind the glass. Her hair had been unnaturally blonded by some expensive shop in Moscow. She needed another treatment, since there was a hint of dark brown at the roots. But it went well with her cheekbones and eyes, which were not quite any shade of blue he'd ever seen in a woman's eyes. That was probably a hook for her repeat customers, the color, he thought, but not the expression. Her body could have been sculpted by Phidias of Athens to be a goddess fit for public worship. Ample curves everywhere. The legs thinner than normal for Russian tastes, but ones that would have gotten along well at the corner of Hollywood and Vine, if that were still a nice neighborhood in which to be spotted. But the expression in her lovely eyes could have stopped the heart of a marathon runner. What was it about prostitution that did this to women? Riley shook his head. He hadn't worked that particular class of crime very often. It was mainly a violation for local cops. And not enough, he supposed, to understand its practitioners. The look in her eyes was frightening. Only men were supposed to be predators, so he and most men thought. But this woman belied that belief to a fare-thee-well. Her name was Tanya Bogdanova. She was, she said, 23 years of age. She had the face of an angel and the body of a movie star. It was her heart and soul the FBI agent was unsure of. Maybe she was just wired differently from normal people, as so many career criminals seem to be. Maybe she'd been sexually abused in her youth. But even at 23, her youth was a very distant thing, judging from the way her eyes looked at her interrogator. Riley looked down at her dossier folder from militia headquarters. There was only one shot of her in it, a distant black and white of her with a John. Well, probably an Ivan, Riley thought with a grunt. And in this photo her face was animated, youthful, and as alluring as the young Ingrid Bergman had been to Bogey in Casablanca. Tanya could act, Riley thought. If this were the real Tanya in front of him, as it probably was, then the one in the photo was a construct, a role to be played, an illusion. A wonderful one, to be sure, but potentially a highly dangerous lie to anyone taken in by it. The girl on the other side of the one-way mirror could have dug a man's eyeballs out with her nail file, and then eaten them raw before going to her next appointment at the new Moscow Four Seasons Hotel and Convention Center. "Who were his enemies, Tanya?" the militiaman asked in the interrogation room. "Who were his friends?" she asked in bored reply. "He had none. Of enemies he had many." Her spoken language was literate and almost refined. Her English was supposed to be excellent as well. Well, she doubtless needed that for her customers. It was probably worth a few extra bucks, D-marks, pounds, or euros. A nice hard currency for whose printed notes she'd give a discount. Doubtless smiling in a coquettish way when she told her John, Jean, Ioannis, or Ivan about it. Before or after? Riley wondered. He'd never paid for it, though looking at Tanya, he understood why some men might. "What's she charge?" he whispered to Provolov. "More than I can afford," the detective lieutenant grunted. "Something like 600 euros, probably more for an entire evening. She is medically clean, remarkably enough. A goodly collection of condoms in her purse, American, French, and Japanese brands." "What's her background? Ballet, something like that?" the FBI agent asked, commenting implicitly on her grace. Provolov grunted in amusement. "No, her tits are too big for that, and she's too tall. She weighs about, 55 kilos or so, I would imagine. Too much for one of those little fairies in the Bolshoi to pick up and throw about. She could become a model for our growing fashion industry, but no, on what you ask, her background is quite ordinary. Her father, deceased, was a factory worker. and her mother, also deceased, worked in a consumer goods store. They both died of conditions consistent with alcohol abuse. Our Tanya drinks only in moderation. State education, undistinguished grades in that. No siblings, our Tanya is quite alone in the world, and has been so for some time. She's been working for Rasputin for almost 4 years. I doubt the Sparrow School ever turned out so polished a whore as this one. Grigory Filipovich himself used her many times, whether for sex or just for his public escort, we are not sure. And she is a fine adornment, is she not? But whatever affection he may have had for her, as you see, was not reciprocated. Anyone close to her? Provolov shook his head. None known to us. Not even a woman friend of note. The interview was pure vanilla, Riley saw, like fishing for bass in a well-stocked lake. One of 27 interrogations to this point concerning the death of G.F. Avseyenko. Everyone seemed to forget the fact that there had been two additional human beings in the car, but they probably hadn't been the targets. It wasn't getting any easier. What they really needed was the truck, something with physical evidence. Like most FBI agents, Riley believed in tangibles, something you could hold in your hand, then pass off to a judge or jury, and have them know it was both evidence of a crime and proof of who had done it. Eyewitnesses, on the other hand, were often liars. At best, they were easy for defense lawyers to confuse, and therefore they were rarely trusted by cops or juries. The truck might have blast residue from the RPG launch, maybe fingerprints on the greasy wrapping paper the Russians used for their weapons, maybe anything. Best of all would be a cigarette smoked by the driver or the shooter, since the FBI could DNA match the residual saliva on that to anyone, which was one of the Bureau's best new tricks. 600 million to 1 odds were hard for people to argue with, even highly paid defense attorneys. One of Riley's pet projects was to bring over the DNA technology for the Russian police to use. But for that, the Russians would have to front the cash for the lab gear, which would be a problem. The Russians didn't seem to have the cash for anything important. All they had now was the remainder of the RPG warhead. It was amazing how much of the things actually did survive launch and detonation, which had a serial number that was being run down, though it was doubtful that this bit of information would lead anywhere. But you ran them all down because you never knew what was valuable and what was not until you got to the finish line, which was usually in front of a judge's bench with 12 people in a box off to your right. Things were a little different here in Russia, procedurally speaking, but the one thing he was trying to get through to the Russian cops, he counseled, was that the aim of every investigation was a conviction. They were getting it, slowly for most, quickly for a few, and also getting the fact that kicking a suspect's balls into his throat was not an effective interrogation technique. They had a constitution in Russia, but public respect for it still needed growing, and it would take time. The idea of the rule of law in this country was as foreign as a man from Mars. The problem, Riley thought, was that neither he nor anyone else knew how much time there was for Russians to catch up with the rest of the world. There was much here to admire, especially in the arts. Because of his diplomatic status, Riley and his wife often got complimentary tickets to concerts, which he liked, and the ballet, which his wife loved. And that was still the class of the world. But the rest of the country had never kept up. Some at the embassy, some of the older CIA people who'd been here before the fall of the USSR, said that the improvements were incredible. But if that were true, Riley told himself, then what had been here before must have been truly dreadful to behold, though the Bolshoi had probably still been the Bolshoi, even then. "That is all?" Tanya Bogdanova asked in the interrogation room. "Yes, thank you for coming in. We may call you again." Use this number, she said, handing over her business card. It's for my cellular phone. That was one more Western convenience in Moscow for those who had hard currency. And Tanya obviously did. The interrogator was a young militia sergeant. He stood politely and moved to get the door for her, showing Bogdanova the courtesy she'd come to expect from men. In the case of Westerners, it was for her physical attributes. In the case of her countrymen, it was her clothing that told them of her newfound worth. Riley watched her eyes as she left the room. The expression was like that of a child who'd expected to be caught doing something naughty but hadn't. How stupid father was, that sort of smile proclaimed. It seemed so misplaced on the angel face, but there it was, on the other side of the mirror. Oleg? Yes, Misha, Provalov turned. She's dirty, man. She's a player, Riley said in English. Provalov knew the cop Americanisms. I agree, Misha, but I have nothing to hold her on, do I? I suppose not. Might be interesting to keep an eye on her, though. If I could afford her, I would keep more than my eye on her, Mikhail Ivanich. Riley grunted amusement. Yeah, I hear that. But she has a heart of ice. That's a fact, the FBI agent agreed. And the game in which she was a player was at best nasty, and at its worst, lethal. So, what do we have? Ed Foley asked, some hours later across the river from Washington. Garnished so far, Mary Pat replied to her husband's question. Jack wants to be kept up to speed on this one. Well, tell the president that we're running as fast as we can, and all we have so far is from the legal attaché. He's in tight with the local cops, but they don't seem to know shit either. Maybe somebody tried to kill Sergei Nikolaevich, but the legat says he thinks Rasputin was the real target. I suppose he had his share of enemies, the director of Central Intelligence conceded. Thank you, the vice president concluded to the packed house at the Ole Miss Fieldhouse. The purpose of the speech was to announce that 8 new destroyers would be built in the big Lytton shipyard on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, which meant jobs and money for the state, always items of concern for the governor, who was now standing and applauding as though the Ole Miss football team had just knocked off Texas at the Cotton Bowl. They took their sports seriously down here. And their politics, Robbie reminded himself, stifling a curse for this tawdry profession that was so much like medieval bargaining in a village square. 3 good pigs for a cow or something. Toss in a mug of bitter ale. Was this how one governed a country? He grinned as he shook his head. Well, there had been politics in the Navy, too, and he'd scaled those heights, but he'd done it by being one hell of a good naval officer, and the best fucking fighter pilot ever to catapult off a flat top. On the last score, of course he knew that every fighter pilot sitting and waiting for the cat shot felt exactly the same way. It was just that he was totally correct in his self-assessment. There were the usual hands to shake coming off the platform, guided by his Secret Service detail in their dark, forbidding shades, then down the steps and out the back door to his car, where another squad of armed men waited, their vigilant eyes looking ever outward, like the gunners on a B-17 over Schweinfurt must have done, the vice president thought. One of them held open the car door, and Robbie slid in. Tomcat is rolling, the chief of the VP detail told his microphone as the car headed off. Robbie picked up his briefing folder as the car got onto the highway for the airport. Anything important happening in D.C.? Not that they've told me about, the Secret Service agent answered. Jackson nodded. These were good people looking after him. The detail chief, he figured, was a medium to senior captain, and the rest of his troops, JGs to lieutenant commanders, which was how Robbie treated them. They were underlings, but good ones, well-trained pros who merited the smile and the nod when they did things right, which they nearly always did. They would have made good aviators, most of them, and the rest probably good Marines. The car finally pulled up to the VC-20B jet in an isolated corner of the general aviation part of the airport, surrounded by yet more security troops. The driver stopped the car just 20 feet from the foot of the self-extending stairs. "You going to drive us home, sir?" the detail chief asked, suspecting the answer.
"Bet your ass, Sam," was the smiling reply.
That didn't please the USAF captain detailed to be co-pilot on the aircraft, and it wasn't all that great for the lieutenant colonel supposed to be the pilot in command of the modified Gulfstream III. The vice president liked to have the stick, in his case the yoke, in his hands at all times, while the colonel worked the radio and monitored the instruments. The aircraft spent most of its time on autopilot, of course, but Jackson, right seat or not, was determined to be the command pilot on the flight, and you couldn't very well say no to him. As a result, the captain would sit in the back and the colonel would be in the left seat, but jerking off. What the hell, the latter thought. The vice president told good stories, and was a fairly competent stick for a Navy puke.
"Clear right," Jackson said a few minutes later.
"Clear left," the pilot replied, confirming the fact from the plane walker in front of the Gulfstream. "Starting one," Jackson said next, followed 30 seconds later by "starting two." The ribbon gauges came up nicely.
"Looking good, sir," the USAF lieutenant colonel reported.
The G had Rolls-Royce Spey engines, the same that had once been used on the UK versions of the F-4 Phantom fighter, but somewhat more reliable.
"Tower, this is Air Force 2, ready to taxi."
"Air Force 2, Tower, cleared to taxiway 3.
"Roger, Tower AF2 taxiing via 3.
Jackson slipped the brakes and let the aircraft move, its fighter engines barely above idle, but guzzling a huge quantity of fuel for all that. On a carrier, Jackson thought, you had plane handlers in yellow shirts to point you around. Here you had to go according to the map/diagram, clipped to the center of the yoke, to the proper place, all the while looking around to make sure some idiot in a Cessna 172 didn't stray into your path like a stray car in the supermarket parking lot. Finally, they reached the end of the runway and turned to face down it.
"Tower, this is Spade requesting permission to take off."
It just sort of came out on its own.
A laughing reply.
"This ain't the Enterprise, Air Force 2, and we don't have cat shots here, but you are clear to depart, sir."
You could hear the grin in the reply.
"Roger, Tower, AF2 is rolling."
"Your call sign was really Spade?" the assigned command pilot asked as the VC-20B started rolling.
"Got hung on by my first CO, back when I was a new nugget, and it kind of stuck."
The vice president shook his head.
"Jesus, that seems like a long time ago."
"V1, sir," the Air Force officer said next, followed by VR.
At velocity rotation, Jackson eased back on the yoke, bringing the aircraft off the ground and into the air. The colonel retracted the landing gear on command, while Jackson flipped the wheel half an inch left and right, rocking the wings a little as he always did to make sure the aircraft was willing to do what he told it. It was, and inside of 3 minutes the G was on autopilot, programmed to turn, climb, and level out at 39,000 feet.
"Boring, isn't it?"
"Just another word for safe, sir," the USAF officer replied.
"Fucking trash hauler," Jackson thought.
No fighter pilot would say something like that out loud.
Since when was flying supposed to be... Well, Robbie had to admit to himself, he always buckled his seatbelt before starting his car, and never did anything reckless, even with a fighter plane. But it offended him that this aircraft, like almost all of the new ones, did so much of the work that he'd been trained to do himself.
It would even land itself. Well, the Navy had such systems aboard its carrier aircraft, but no proper naval aviator ever used it unless ordered to, something Robert Jefferson Jackson had always managed to avoid. This trip would go into his logbook as time in command, but it really wasn't. Instead, it was a microchip in command, and his real function was to be there to take proper action in case something broke. But nothing ever did, even the damned engines. Once turbojets had lasted a mere 9 or 10 hours before having to be replaced. Now there were Spey engines on the G-Fleet that had 12,000 hours. There was one out there with over 30,000 that Rolls-Royce wanted back, offering a free brand-new replacement because its engineers wanted to tear that one apart to learn what they'd done so right. But the owner, perversely and predictably, refused to part with it. The rest of the Gulfstream airframe was about that reliable, and the electronics were utterly state-of-the-art, Jackson knew, looking down at the color display from the weather radar. It was a clear and friendly black at the moment, showing what was probably smooth air all the way to Andrews. There was, as yet, no instrument that detected turbulence, but up here at flight level 390, that was a pretty rare occurrence, and Jackson wasn't often susceptible to air sickness, and his hand was inches from the yoke in case something unexpected happened. Jackson occasionally hoped that something would happen, since it would allow him to show just how good an aviator he was. But it never did. Flying had become too routine since his childhood in the F-4N Phantom and his emerging manhood in the F-14A Tomcat. And maybe it was better that way. Yeah, he thought. Sure. Mr. Vice President? It was the voice of the USAF communications sergeant aboard the VC-20. Robbie turned to see her with a sheaf of papers. Yes, Sarge? Flash traffic just came in on the printer. She extended her hand, and Robbie took the paper. Colonel, your airplane for a while, the VP told the lieutenant colonel in the left seat. Pilot's airplane, the colonel agreed, while Robbie started reading. It was always the same, even though it was also always different. The cover sheet had the usual classification formatting. It had once impressed Jackson that the act of showing a sheet of paper to the wrong person could land him in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. At the time, actually, the since-closed Portsmouth Naval Prison in New Hampshire. But now, as a senior government official in Washington, D.C., he knew he could show damned near anything to a reporter from the Washington Post and not be touched for it. It wasn't so much that he was above the law, as he was one of the people who decided what the law meant. What was so damned secret and sensitive in this case was that CIA didn't know shit about the possible attempt on the life of Russia's chief spymaster, which meant nobody else in Washington did either. Chapter 3 The Problems with Riches. The issue was trade, not exactly the president's favorite. But then, at this level, every issue took on sufficient twists that even the ones you thought you knew about became strange at best, unknown and alien at worst. George, Ryan said to his Secretary of the Treasury, George Winston. Mr. Pres... God damn it, George! The president nearly spilled his coffee with the outburst. Okay. Sec Trez nodded submission. It's hard to make the adjustment. Jack. Ryan was getting tired of the presidential trappings, and his rule was that here in the Oval Office his name was Jack, at least for his inner circle, of which Winston was one. After all, Ryan had joked a few times, after leaving this marble prison, he might be working for Trader, as the Secret Service knew him, back in New York on the street, instead of the other way round. After leaving the presidency, something for which Jack prostrated himself before God every night, or so the stories went, he'd have to find gainful employment somewhere, and the trading business beckoned. Ryan had shown a rare gift for it, Winston reminded himself. His last such effort had been a California company called Silicon Alchemy,
just one of many computer outfits, but the only one in which Ryan had taken an interest. So skillfully had he brought that firm to IPO that his own stock holdings in SALC, its symbol on the big board, were now valued at just over $80 million, making Ryan by far the wealthiest American president in history. It was something his politically astute chief of staff, Arnold Van Dam, did not advertise to the news media, who typically regarded every wealthy man as a robber baron, excepting, of course, the owners of the papers and TV stations themselves, who were, of course, the best of public-spirited citizens. None of this was widely known, even in the tight community of Wall Street big hitters, which was remarkable enough. Should he ever return to the street, Ryan's prestige would be sufficient to earn money while he slept in his bed at home. And that, Winston freely admitted, was something well and truly earned, and be damned to whatever the media hounds thought of it. "It's China?" Jack asked. "That's right, boss," Winston confirmed with a nod. Boss was a term Ryan could stomach, as it was also the in-house term the Secret Service, which was part of Winston's Department of the Treasury, used to identify the man they were sworn to protect. "They're having a little cash shortfall problem, and they're looking to make it up with us." "How little?" POTUS asked. "It looks as though it will annualize out to, oh, $70 billion or so." "Well, that is, as we say, real money." George Winston nodded. "Anything that starts with a B is real enough, and this is a little better than 6 B's a month." "Spending it for what?" "Not entirely sure, but a lot of it has to be military-related. The French arms industries are tight with them now, since the Brits kiboshed the jet engine deal from Rolls-Royce." The president nodded, looking down at the briefing papers. "Yeah, Basil talked the PM out of it." That was Sir Basil Charleston, chief of the British Secret Intelligence Service, sometimes called, erroneously, MI6. Basil was an old friend of Ryan's, going back to his CIA days. "It was a remarkably stand-up thing to do." "Well, our friends in Paris don't seem to think the same way." "They usually don't," Ryan agreed. The odd thing was the dichotomy inherent in dealing with the French. In some things, they weren't so much allies as blood brothers, but in others, they were less than mere associates, and Ryan had trouble figuring out the logic by which the French changed their minds. "Well," the president thought, "that's what I have a State Department for." "So you think the PRC is building up its military again?" "Big time. But not so much their navy, which makes our friends in Taiwan feel a little better." That had been one of President Ryan's foreign policy initiatives after concluding hostilities with the defunct United Islamic Republic, now restored to the separate nations of Iran and Iraq, which were at least at peace with each other. The real reasons for the recognition of Taiwan had never been made known to the public. It looked pretty clear to Ryan and his Secretary of State, Scott Adler, that the People's Republic of China had played a role in the Second Persian Gulf War, and probably in the preceding conflict with Japan as well. Exactly why? Well, some in CIA thought that China lusted after the mineral riches in eastern Siberia. This was suggested by intercepts and other access to the electronic mail of the Japanese industrialists who'd twisted their nation's path into a not-quite-open clash with America. They'd referred to Siberia as the Northern Resource Area, hearkening back to when an earlier generation of Japanese strategists had called South Asia the Southern Resource Area. That had been part of another conflict, one known to history as the Second World War. In any case, the complicity of the PRC with America's enemies had merited a countermove, Ryan and Adler had agreed, and besides, the Republic of China on Taiwan was a democracy, with government officials elected by the people of that nation island, and that was something America was supposed to respect. "You know, it would be better if they started working their navy and threatening Taiwan. We are in a better position to forestall that than..."
You really think so? Sektrez asked, cutting his president off.
The Russians do, Jack confirmed.
Then why are the Russians selling the Chinese so much hardware? Winston demanded. That doesn't make sense.
George, there is no rule demanding that the world has to make sense.
That was one of Ryan's favorite aphorisms.
That's one of the things you learn in the intelligence business. In 1938, guess who was Germany's number one trading partner?
Sektrez saw that sandbag coming before it struck.
France?
You got it.
Ryan nodded.
Then, in 40 and 41, they did a lot of trade with the Russians.
That didn't work out so well either, did it?
And everyone always told me that trade was a moderating influence, the secretary observed.
Maybe it is among people, but remember that governments don't have principles so much as interests. At least the primitive ones. The ones who haven't figured it all out yet.
Like the PRC?
It was Ryan's turn to nod.
Yeah, George, like those little bastards in Beijing. They rule a nation of 1 billion people, but they do it as though they were the new coming of Caligula. Nobody ever told them that they have a positive duty to look after the interests of the people they rule.
Well, maybe that's not true, Ryan allowed, feeling a little generous.
They have this big, perfect theoretical model, promulgated by Karl Marx, refined by Lenin, then applied in their country by a pudgy sexual pervert named Mao.
Oh? Pervert?
Yeah.
Ryan looked up.
We had the data over at Langley.
Mao liked virgins. The younger the better.
Maybe he liked to see the fear in their cute little virginal eyes. That's what one of our pershrink consultants thought. Kinda like rape, not so much sex as power.
Well, I guess it could have been worse.
At least they were girls, Jack observed rather dryly.
And their culture is historically a little more liberal than ours on that sort of thing.
A shake of the head.
You should see the briefs I get whenever a major foreign dignitary comes over. The stuff we know about their personal habits.
A chuckle.
Do I really want to know?
A grimace.
Probably not.
Sometimes I wish they didn't give me the stuff. You sit them down right here in the office, and they're charming and businesslike, and you can spend the whole fucking meeting looking for horns and hooves.
That could be a distraction, of course, but it was more generally thought that, as in playing poker for high stakes, the more you knew about the guy on the other side of the table, the better, even if it might make you want to throw up during the welcoming ceremony on the White House South Lawn. But that was the business of being president, Ryan reminded himself. And people actually fought like tigers to get there.
And would again when he left, POTUS reminded himself.
And so, Jack, is it your job to protect your country from the kind of rat who lusts to be where all the really good cheese is stored?
Ryan shook his head again.
So many doubts.
It wasn't so much that they never went away. They just kept getting bigger all the time. How strange that he understood and could recount every small step that had led him to this office. And yet he still asked himself several times every hour how the hell he'd come to be in this place, and how the hell he'd ever get out. Well, he had no excuses at all this time. He'd actually run for election to the presidency, if you could call it that. Arnie Van Dam didn't, as a matter of fact. Which you could, since he'd fulfilled the constitutional requirements, a fact on which just about every legal scholar in the nation had agreed, and talked about on every major news network ad nauseam.